that I first heard the Messiah sung in the Pasadena Civic Auditorium, I was impressed with it. Whether it is always presented in the same manner, I think what made it as impressive to start with, this must be now 20 years or more ago, was the voice of the man who read it. And then to have it sung in the character, as you heard it today, has always been impressive to me. It is a remarkable composition with respect to the time during which it was created, if any of you know the background of the work. I would like to just make a few comments since I have not been to this Congress. Many years ago that I first heard the Messiah sung in the Pasadena Civic Auditorium, I was impressed with it. Whether it is always presented in the same manner, I think what made it as impressive to start with, this must be now 20 years or more ago, was the voice of the man who read it. And then to have it sung in the character, as you heard it today, has always been impressive to me. It is a remarkable composition with respect to the time during which it was created, if any of you know the background of the work. I would like to just make a few comments since I have not been to this congregation for some time. I had the privilege of going to Oregon on two occasions because of the problem, and there was not any question in my mind that there were some people up there who were very greatly disturbed. Certainly there was a significant responsibility that fell upon two or more in the ministry, one of whom was there, sent by headquarters, and the other who was in an area, though it was not directly affecting the region, but has since been involved in problems with respect to the Eugene congregation. I certainly can feel for Mr. Scriber. I've had some very nice letters, few in number, but you don't have to have that many. The brethren in Klamath Falls, for instance, normally meet once in a while and have, after the service, a kind of potluck. And I guess they had it twice, and I was there each of the times. That's at least the way it was scheduled. And they had one since. And more than one person, two, three, I'm not sure how many, wrote and mentioned how much they remembered the fact that some of us, Mr. McNair, Raymond McNair, Mr. Pyle, who were up there at the same time, were with the brethren. And they do certainly reflect something of the state of mind the brethren today, as distinct from some of the hostile questions and doubts that we had to face when we were there before. We have good news as far as the trends elsewhere go in South Africa. I'm pleased that the man who sat with me in the Bible study now some several weeks ago in the auditorium, Mr. Jaap Kreisel, I mentioned this the last time, at the Bible study that I took, that he was very grateful to have had that privilege. And certainly he has mentioned to government leaders in South Africa, whom he knows on a personal, first-name basis, because the whole country only has 4.5 million white people. When you have that few number, you're bound to have prominent individuals in the church. By the very nature of society, the same way as in the Republic of Fiji and the Kingdom of Tonga, men who are either related to or know the highest officials in government. Here it is quite different. Dr. Zimmerman is not acquainted with President Ford. Neither am I. But it does mean that South Africa and officials in the government there, and of course in Rhodesia, become more and more aware of our presence. which is very important in an area where the government makes decisions. As I have mentioned in the study, but I just want to rehearse and give you the feeling, in the area of Rhodesia, one-time member of the British Commonwealth, there is a man who is Roman Catholic, who is the radio and TV czar, or the czar of communications in the country. And he makes the decision as to what is on radio and television and what is not. Because he made a decision, I was interviewed on TV when I was in Rhodesia. Because he made a decision, the Garner Ted Armstrong program appears once a week free. Because he thinks the church, meaning the Roman Catholic Church, should hear what we have to say. It's a strange thing to have that. When we have this kind of doubt that we have addressed in Oregon in the discussion already that has been given you, I think we need to realize when Roman Catholics this high up in responsible position believe we have something to say not only to the country but to their own members, perhaps we ought to give more heed among ourselves. When we speak to each other, you might draw the contrast and ask whose ears are open and whose are closed. Also, the events are moving. It's a matter of contact and waiting for response. It is possible that one of our staff members in Sydney will be invited to the great gathering that takes place once a year in New Guinea of the various tribes. New Guinea, of course, on September 16 became an independent nation. Mr. Don Abraham is the gentleman. Some of you know him. He also asked me if I would like to accompany him to New Guinea. This is where the cannibals and headhunters still function. But usually when they come to a festive occasion like this, they present themselves in an entirely different light to the public at large. Though they behave in some categories, as I mentioned, among themselves in the hills. It's a way that has been devised by the government to release some of the aggression. I thought it would be a fine opportunity, since the woman who has invited him is herself a descendant of the Chiefly families in New Guinea, married to an Australian man, and it would be possible for us then to be introduced to some of the chiefs in New Guinea who are involved in the new government. And Mr. Abraham thought that I should like to go there, which of course I told him I would. It's one place in the world that I would want to take my wife because it is so unusual. I suspect that at least one of us would come back. We don't know sometimes what connections can develop. I have sent copies of Human Potential to be judged by our staff. Not every issue might be as acceptable in some of the countries that have very restrained views, because we do have two articles, one accompanying another, on sexual relationships, which might be considered perfectly satisfactory for our society, but I want to be sure it is not objectionable in some of the more closed traditional societies affected by Victorian morals. But I hope that it will be found satisfactory. I've sent some copies to our friend in Fiji, who is the director of agriculture, who said that he would present copies to the three chiefs, as well perhaps as a governor general, who is his brother-in-law, who represents Queen Elizabeth, to let them be acquainted with our program at this level. You see, here we have situations where Mr. Armstrong has not yet made contact, but where indeed God has called, interestingly enough, into his church men at the highest or next highest level, below the leader in the country. whereas Mr. Armstrong heretofore has often been in countries where we have only had secular relationships. That is, Mr. Armstrong has not dealt with converted members of the Japanese Diet, not dealt with converted members of the government in the Southeast governments in Southeast Asia or India or Sri Lanka or Bangladesh, for that matter, Africa either. But interestingly, in this area of the South Pacific, we already have men who are in the church and at very high levels of government. And I think this is something to be very grateful for. Mr. Kanamaui, he's called a chief. He goes by the title of Ratu, which means chief, is probably the next most important individual in Fiji after the three chiefs, who are all related, and the governor general, who's his brother-in-law. So we can't get very much higher than the governor general. And I think that it is marvelous that God has opened that kind of a door, and he can make the contact and understand what those people need to know. In the same way, in Tonga, we have a man who is known, who works in the Department of Agriculture, a man whose wife is in the church, who himself is probably the most prominent businessman in the island. He used to attend, but he really is not a converted man, but a very helpful individual, who introduced me to the undersecretary in the prime minister's office, who happens to be of German-English descent. Anyone below a secretary may be a foreigner. Above that, you have to be a native Tongan. And he said that he would be pleased also to present to the government a copy of Human Potential. So I'm mentioning this so that you understand that in many of these outlying areas of the world, there is a way to reach individuals, not with a booklet, The Plain Truth About Christmas. Let that come later. But with an understanding of what it is that we stand for in terms of our approach toward life and the way of life and the world's problems. I've also sent a copy to the son-in-law of the Governor General of what we call Western or British Samoa. He is a co-worker. He is married to the stepdaughter of the Governor General. His wife, therefore, is Polynesian. I have had dinner with them both. My wife has met them both before they were married, and I hope this will be of some benefit there as well. So little by little, we reach some of these exotic areas of the world that would be very expensive to travel in, because the islands are so far removed for so few people who are there. So in that sense, God may be using the individuals who are there to do some of the work for us, and I have been grateful to have had the opportunity to become acquainted with these individuals. I would like to address today a question that in a sense follows the theme of the sermonette that was given. Mr. Davis asked me what I had in mind, and at the time I had made no decision, but I had a subject in mind in general that I might cover. So since I found what he would discuss, I thought I would follow that up and go through a number of verses in the Bible that give us something of the state of the church through history, and if you please, the state of the church as given in prophecy, so that we can see how many things we should have been aware of. There are many verses in the Bible that in fact describe the situation that has been, is now, and shall be. We may be familiar with certain verses in the New Testament about what might befall the church, or maybe in a prophecy in the book of Daniel, but there are numerous other areas of Scripture. These areas pertain to problems that can happen at any time. Paul tells us that the scriptures of which he was referring, and that which he was referring to was the Old Testament. At that time, though it did not exclude a few others, but he was clearly having reference to the Old Testament, it was written for our learning. That is, there were experiences there that give us examples so that if we confront a problem of a similar nature, we will know how to conduct ourselves. There are individuals that I think were correctly described who have left and followed wolves in sheep's clothing, shepherds who fed them. Then there are others who just dropped by the wayside, or as one lady whom I highly respected years ago in one of the local congregations said, "Well, I just can't stand to be in a situation where there is controversy," so she left to go to the quiet waters of the Church of God Seventh Day, where nobody has really spiritually drunk in years. That's a sad situation, but that's the state of it. She was not spiritually mature enough that she could face up to problems. I wondered myself when that happened what she would have done when the winds blew the night the Red Sea opened. Would she have gone back to the quiet slavery of Egypt? But let's take a look at periods of time and analyze the state of people, sometimes a people who are converted, sometimes a people who are God's people but to whom he has not given his spirit. We look at events, the state of mind and character of individuals and groups in the period of the patriarchs, or that of the founding of the Old Testament church in the days of Moses, the long period of centuries in the days of the judges, the state of affairs in that same church when it split in two and became Israel and Judah during the time of the later kings. Then we have the post-captivity period of Haggai and Zechariah, followed by Ezra and Nehemiah. And then, of course, that which is not recorded directly in Scripture, the days of Antiochus Epiphanes, but really is recorded by way of a prophecy in Daniel 11. The state of affairs that is the backdrop for the ministry of Jesus and the apostles at the earliest period in the book of Acts. The state of affairs in the world and therefore in the churches in the days of Paul in the earlier and later periods of his ministry. And then the seven periods of time through history, including that time till now. And I think we'll be quite surprised at the state of things. So I want to address myself to some fundamentals, and I hope you will listen. The one thing that we must recognize is that Christ does not always govern his church as you might think he would. And I think if we understand that, we understand much more of the history of the church and therefore the present state of the church and the future state of the church. And he does not always govern it in the same way. Not only may he not govern it as you think, but he doesn't always govern the church in the same way in every century. Now, before we look at that question, let us also look at another parallel area. In a sense, God instituted the human family. And in instituting the human family, he made the husband the head of the wife, and Christ, in that sense, the head of the husband. That is, every family has, in terms of the rearing of children, a responsibility directly to God, as well as to larger groups on earth, such as church or state, in whatever different levels we have, our city and our county, or, you know, our state, and of course the federal, and now the United Nations, and all this, and sooner or later we are all related one way or another, and maybe it's no more than through the tax structure, maybe it's through our transportation system, maybe it's through the school system. But every family is ultimately responsible to Christ. Now, we're talking here of the church. We're not addressing the world that is cut off. Now, you might assume that if the ministry is responsible to Christ, that God rules all ministers just alike throughout all ages. But if you look at the parallel, you will discover that Christ does not rule every family the same way.
He rules through individuals, and not every individual responds the same way. That is, the rule of Christ is far more indirect than we thought. But when he should choose to act, it is often far more direct than we could ever imagine. Most parents seek in the church, I didn't say all parents because I know that is not true. Most parents seek to convey the will of God to their children. Now, accompanying the will of God is often the will of the parents. It's sometimes difficult for children to discern the difference, and sometimes difficult for the parents. What must be recognized, of course, is that in any case, and this I think has been lost sight of, children are told to honor their parents because without them they wouldn't even be here. And I think children have tended to forget that. Without parents, none of us would be here. That is the way God set it up. Therefore, whether our parents are behaving altogether correctly or not, we have a responsibility to give them honor because they brought us into the world. There are some parents who are strict, some who are lenient, and some who don't care at all. In the same way, through history, we have ministers who are strict, ministers who are lenient, and some who apparently haven't cared at all what happened to the flock. Now, you might assume that if Christ is the head, you see, of the husband and the husband of the wife, that Christ ought to be able to reach the wife always the same way, no matter through what man, and it isn't so. The fact remains that God allows, through Christ, many a husband to do some things that are his own will and not Christ's will. In the same way, the ministry has been allowed sometimes to do its own will and not Christ's will. And if you think that is not possible, then you're blind to your relationship as a family to Christ, and you better open your mind and see it. And if people had the eyes to see the one, they would also have the eyes to see the other. And since we all live, in one sense or another, in the experience of the one in the family unit, most of us should have been mature enough then to face up to any weaknesses that might have appeared in the administration and government of the church, just as you would have lived through weaknesses and strengths in any family situation. My family is ruled according to certain principles, but our children are sometimes not allowed the same privileges that others are, or sometimes are allowed privileges that others are not. In the same way, through the history of the church, members of the church sometimes are allowed privileges at one period that they are not allowed at another. And we might as well face the reality of it. And because two people, two fathers, two mothers, doesn't matter in this case, but let's say where parents are both converted, but children are not always allowed the same thing, doesn't mean that one is in the church and the other is not. And therefore, when there are different administrations in the church over periods of time, it doesn't mean one was the church and one was not. It means that Christ is allowing different administrations because human beings behave differently. And so I have simply summarized it so that everybody gets the point. If what we are asked at one period is to have dichondra in our lawn, that's what we shall have. And if at another time we have Kentucky bluegrass, that's what we shall have. In any case, we're having a lawn. And are we big enough to face up to these variations? That is, every woman must learn that the husband she married is not quite the man she thought she married. My wife is the rule, not the exception. But it's also the other way. Every man also learns that the woman he married is not quite the one he thought. Sometimes it's better. I'm happy to see Mrs. Listman smile because I'm sure she could say that. In her life, she lived through many years and seen the state of the church with its ups and downs. We have to realize then that every human being has traits that are. And when it comes to decision making, every human being will in some way vary from another in terms of what is important and significant to him or to her. And the same human being may vary through periods of time as that individual either matures or decays. And we can all do either if we are not careful. There are ministers who grow and mature. There are ministers who grow and mature, and then for some reason, which I won't have to address at this moment, they allow a stumbling block to get in their way and decay, and decisions vary and they're no longer the same as they were. And maybe they come to themselves and maybe they don't. And there are individuals who perhaps never really grew and matured. I think we haven't looked at it this way and compared the state of the church with the state of the family and analyzed whether or not, which of course the Chinese would have done long ago, whether the state of the church reflects the state of the family. And whether the state of the ministry, in fact, reflects the state of the husbands who are ministers in this case, and asking whether their governance in their own family does not, in fact, reflect how they have governed in the church. Because they're the same human being. I can assure you that there is a far greater parallel in how a man rules the church and how he rules his family than you ever guessed, unless you read the scripture that a man should not be ordained who cannot also rule his family. Now, am I getting it over to you so you can see the picture clearly? And therefore, the state of affairs will, to a great extent, reflect what is in the home. This is the Chinese concept, you see. The state of the nation depends on the state of the family, the state of the family on the state of the individual. So when we have responsible congregations, we may presume, in part, a responsible ministry. But also part of it is the responsibility of the congregation, too. And when we have, therefore, a responsible ministry, we would see reflected also a responsible number of children. Now, if you were to look, brethren, I'm going to be plain so nobody will misunderstand. I think one of the problems today is we don't want to actually point up individuals, and that leads to gossip so that all of you talk it over, and you know who it is, but the minister can't say. This is wrong. This is why we didn't have problems in the past. It's why when we knew there were problems, we faced them, and when they were forgiven, they were also forgotten. Mr. Schreiber, since his name was mentioned, is a responsible minister, and it is reflected not only in the present state of the churches, though he was not able to change the minds of some who had already been poisoned before he got there. That he could not do because that depended on the individual. Whether intellectual arguments of some other minister might have persuaded one or two is irrelevant. But the state of the church now reflects the state of people who are willing to listen. But it is interesting, it is also reflected in the state of his children. Because all those whom I know are with the work and doing the work. I think his son is in Denver, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know all the details. Now, there was a man who preceded Mr. Mosaic. Now, Mr. Mosè is not our strongest minister. He's a younger person who had very grave crises in his early life while he was a teenager. His mother died, and she was a neighbor of ours, and I was there about 8 in the morning when she died. And his father, unfortunately, left. And he has had a very rough experience. And he has shown the kind of character he had, which I think to a great extent reflects the training that his mother was able to convey. But the man who was there before left, and his son, and his daughter, and his son-in-law. And it makes me realize to what extent the way you train your children very greatly will reflect on yourself, or how you discipline yourself to obey Christ under whatever circumstance will sooner or later come out in the behavior of children. So that we had 3 congregations affected because of the way apparently one man reared his family. Now, there was a different kind of situation. We all make mistakes as human beings. And I think that we can see that when Mr. Garner Ted Armstrong had a personal crisis in his life, and his father had to speak to the church about the problem, the remarkable thing is that Mr. Garner Ted Armstrong has said, "You know, at that time, nobody left and followed me." He wasn't asking anyone to. But the fact remains, in 71 and 72, in that period of crisis in his life, the general characterization of Mr. Armstrong's leadership, not only in the church and in the family, was exemplified by the fact that people didn't emotionally go off the deep end. And unlike many in the ministry since, who have gone and have waved goodbye and never come back, Mr. Garner Ted Armstrong did change and did come back. I wish I could say that for most of the other men, but not a one has, to my knowledge. It's very important to realize that we can all have problems. But whether we overcome them and whether we focus on our goals and keep our minds focused on those goals, that will determine the general character of yourself, the congregation, your family, in whatever area you have jurisdiction. When we look at the family of Abraham, we see the effect of the teaching of Abraham in the person of Isaac. We see the effect of the problem between Isaac and his wife in the rearing of their 2 sons, Jacob and Esau. For it is quite clear that Isaac, in a sense, had a favorite, and Rebekah had a favorite. And Jacob's problem was, to a great extent, the fact that instead of Rebekah supporting Isaac, Rebekah was constantly supporting Jacob. And the more she supported him, the more carnal he was, without any question. And it appears that Isaac was not really able to control that situation, because he had married a very strong-willed woman, apparently, who somehow took after her, probably her father, and certainly her brother, dear Laban, you remember? Now, when we come to a later period in life, we see the weaknesses and strengths again showing up. Moses is certainly one of the most remarkable men. Moses was a very meek man, the meekest man on earth at the time. Now, in a way, it is unusual to see the results of a man like that, because it is very interesting that God ruled the church more directly in the days of Moses than he had ever ruled the church at any other time. Have you ever noticed how often God, you know, smashed down on the children of Israel? Day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year. Moses was leading them, but it wasn't Moses who, shall we say, used the rod on them. God, Jesus Christ, because he was the one then, ruled very directly with the children of Israel. Far more directly than he ever ruled in the family of Jacob. Jacob, the actual literal man, and his 12 sons. God certainly was there directly in the case of Abraham, less so in the case of Isaac, and very seldom in the case of Jacob. He was most direct in the days of Moses, and Moses was a very meek man. Now, he did lose his temper once. He tried to control it, apparently, and did very well as a whole. But when you look at Moses' family, you also discover that that meekness apparently went along with a certain weakness. Because Moses' own family did not accomplish what they should. You look in the story of the last portion of the book of Judges, and you will discover that it was Moses' own family that led the children astray, the children of Israel astray. This is very sad. Gershom, the son of Moses, translated there Manasseh because the Jews didn't want to embarrass Moses, so they inserted a little N above the text. You should know that part of the story in the closing chapters of the book of Judges. It was Moses' own grandson who led the children of the Danites into idolatry, and it spread then to the rest of the children of Israel. Moses really couldn't control his wife, who was the Midianitess woman whom he married in the wilderness. Now, in this case, Moses, however, probably perceived his own weaknesses. And he had to rely on the presence of God in a very special way. When we come to the period of the Judges, it's quite different. God doesn't directly rule over the children of Israel anymore. He only indirectly rules. He warns them through the judges, or a seer who is sent. And from time to time, he sends an enemy nation. He doesn't directly act. But it's the same God. It's a different period of time. And if you note, not every judge behaves the same way. Sometimes God uses a woman. Because the man whom God could have used wasn't big enough to face up to the task. Sometimes he uses a judge who has very great strength, and sometimes very great weakness. There was a judge who, in one sense, was both strongest and weakest. The Irishman, Samson, if I may draw an analogy. Samson had a very great weakness for Philistine women, and very great strength when it came to exercising the powers that God supernaturally gave him as long as he was a Nazarite. But he undid his strength often by submitting to his wife, the Philistine woman whom he could not rule. God could have chosen a stronger man than Samson. In fact, at the same time, God was choosing Samuel. But God rules each family and each individual, and therefore the nation or the church, often through the man who is the leader. And the character of the church, and the character, therefore, of individuals in it, will significantly reflect the state of mind of a leader. The spiritual state of the children of Israel in the days of Samuel and Samson was not very good. But on the other hand, what could you expect when you had a man like Samson? If a leader whom God should choose to call and work with has this kind of behavior, who wouldn't even respect his parents' advice to tell him why he doesn't look among his own people instead of among the Philistines, what can you expect of the people around him? That's the state of affairs. Yet, if you had lived in the days of Samson, what would you have done? Joined the Philistines? Worship in the house of Dagon? Gone off to some other country? The answer to the question is, we all have to learn to obey God no matter what the problem. Children should learn to obey God no matter what problems parents have. Husbands and wives should learn to obey God no matter what problem the husband has. We all have to, and to cooperate and to make the family unit work. Now, there's no perfect man and there's no perfect woman. But a man and a woman who are married have to learn to make the family unit work on the basis of their own strengths and weaknesses. In the same way, the children of Israel should have learned to make things work in the days of Samson and Samuel. Samson was younger than Samuel by some few years, but Samuel outlived Samson by many years because Samson was already dead within a 40-year period of time. The state of the church must have, in some way, reflected the common argument. Well, if Samson can be God's judge and do that, then why can't I? Now, one of the things you have to learn, that nobody else's fault can ever be an excuse for you to do the same thing, whether he is your superior or not. If a man drinks too much, this doesn't mean that a woman can do the same in the family. If he can get away with it, doesn't mean she can. If men want to gamble their money away, it doesn't mean that I have to. If people want to do what they want to do, that doesn't mean that you have to do the same thing. You have a book here. In the days of Samson, they had at least a part of the book. They had this much. I just have the Old Testament in this particular bound volume because I'm working with that today. The answer is they could have looked in the law and seen, and they could have known. They don't have to agree with what Samson does, but they at least need to submit to the government of God through him. Now, after he died, Samuel, who was a priest, not a Danite, put his sons, who abused their office, he put them in power. Now, the people undoubtedly said, well, we don't want to have that kind of thing going on because the sons are abusing their office. And they clearly were, financially and sexually. Now, they reasoned, not like they should have. They should have said something like this. Samuel, we recognize God rules through you. We know your sons are in an office, that you have put them there, and we're going to submit to them insofar as they carry out the government of God. But we will not submit our daughters and our pocketbooks to their sins. No, they didn't say anything like that. They argued with Samuel and said, you know, his sons weren't doing right. And they then turned around and did something even worse because they entered into a state of rebellion. And they said, we don't want God ruling through you or your sons. We want a king. Assuming the king, of course, is going to put his sons, who would never sin like Samuel's sons were doing, which would be ridiculous. So the people entered into a sin that was even greater. Now, if you'd been in that day, what would you have said? Remember, this is the church, the only church God was working through. It was a physical church. But nevertheless, it was the congregation of Israel. You could have left, and you'd have left the government of God, or you could have stayed there and in patience endured. Now, when the children of Israel revolted, God finally spoke to Samuel, and he said, now, remember, they're really rejecting me and not you. Because when they ask for a king, they're saying that they don't want me ruling through you. So God said, let's have them have a king. But that's what they want. And God sometimes allows people to have what they want. He allowed Balaam to have some of what he wanted. And the children of Israel wanted a king, and he allows them to have what they want. There's sometimes children who want to have certain things, and parents sometimes will allow them and sometimes will not. And there are people in the church today who want certain liberty. The liberty to make the lack of knowledge the new knowledge that we can't know, which is the new approach of some. Or we want to be able to do this and we want to be able to do that. Or if some minister can do this, why can't I do that? You know, this is the new approach that we're using more and more. And brethren, God has allowed it. Because he allowed things in the days of Samson, and he allowed things in the days of Samuel. And he allowed things in the days of Saul. He's going to see what it is that you want done. And on the basis of the people whom he has chosen, or who are placed in positions of authority by those whom he has chosen, the church will be ruled. Now, there isn't any question that the rule of God through Moses differs from the way God ruled through some of the judges, and certainly the way he ruled through Samson. Now, when it came to David, we have an altogether different thing. God there ruled, again, rather indirectly over the people, except on a few instances. He ruled, however, much more directly in the life of David himself than we have a record of in terms of some of the previous individuals. Now, if we look at the person of David, there's one thing I want to dwell on at this point so you understand. There's always the tendency to say, why doesn't God remove someone or change someone? Why does he allow this to happen? Why did he allow men in the United States, and this is where most of it occurred, to be in a pulpit sometimes 1 or 2 years doing some of the deeds they were doing before headquarters ever perceived what was being done? Well, I ask you, why did God allow certain things in the Old Testament? We should have been wiser and had seen more than we did. We should have perhaps realized some of these things, but the fault that is there is no excuse for somebody else to commit the same fault. Now, in the case of David, David was a man who could have said, well, look, God has said I'm to be king, and he has said he's, you know, through with Saul, turned his back on him. Why let Saul stay there any longer? And especially since he had him trapped more than once. Why didn't he just act? Now, the fact is, God would have given David the throne if he had killed Saul. God here tested David to see whether David would recognize whose responsibility it is. In other words, it indeed was God's responsibility to determine when he would remove Saul. God chose it. It did not mean that as long as Saul was there, the people had to do what Saul was doing. Now, if there were people in the congregation where some of these ministers have been in past years and were already causing a certain division, the people had no reason to follow them. They should have followed Christ as he was leading the church as a whole. In this case, they should have been patient, and they certainly shouldn't have fallen away when the minister did. Now, David did not act. He let God act. And you note that God did not act till David was 30 years of age, even though he was already anointed in his kingdom. David could have been king, but David would never have been qualified to be king at 20 or even at 25. He wasn't really ready to govern and to exercise that responsibility until he was 30 years of age. And it is a whole lot better for an individual to let God make those decisions than that we should take it in our hands. Now, if lay people could have realized this, and some of them sensed what was going on, and some of them did not, then those who sensed the problem, who realized there were individuals like Saul who were in fact not submitting themselves to the government of God, they would have said, look, if God allows a minister to be there, fine. That's up to him. We don't have to follow. Now, you know, in some cases, that's in fact what happened. We have congregations. One was in Minneapolis where I think all but three of the people where a minister left, they all stayed with it. And he carried no more than three away. In some cases, the minister carried more than half of the people with him. What we need to realize constantly is that God may choose to do things a little different than we think. Now, God chose Solomon. And there were people undoubtedly who had very good reasons to say, let me tell you, if Solomon is king, the following things will happen. And you know they would have been right. Solomon would have multiplied women. He did. He would have multiplied, in the end, the idol temple. He would have taxed the people to please himself, intellectually and physically. And there was hardly any revival ever expressed in the biblical record in the days of Solomon, just physical things. And everybody who would have told David, look, Solomon will be doing these things, would have been right, and yet to try to keep Solomon from being king would have been wrong. You see, God chose Solomon because he saw in him something that frankly wasn't in the other sons. Solomon never chose to be king on his own. He had his weaknesses. He didn't tell his father, look, my brother's doing this, my other brother's doing that. Solomon left it in God's hands. In the end, of course, it doesn't seem that he left himself in God's hands. That was his problem. But as long as he did, God used him in a way that God could never have used Absalom or Adonijah. Each one who was seeking to do his own thing. Now, God knew that Solomon wasn't perfect. David did, too, because David warned Solomon that if you follow God, he will continue to be with you, and if you depart from him, he will depart from you. And God used him to write several books of the Bible. Now, what God shall choose to do in the case of Solomon is not defined. There are kings that later occurred in Israel that said they did evil in the sight of the Lord, or they did good in the sight of the Lord, or they began to seek the Lord. In the case of Solomon, nothing is said because it's not left to men. God is going to have to judge that case. What his final state will be, God will judge. But thereafter, you could have said, well, why did God have a series of kings when over half of them always went wrong? Couldn't God have raised up somebody to do what was right? Yes, he could. But in fact, if you're going to have a line of kings, you're not going to have somebody in every generation who obeys. And God allowed in the church kings who were very obedient, kings who had certain problems, kings, remember, who made deals with Israel. But he allowed them all. To a great extent, the state of the people reflected the state of the king, the state of the priesthood. Shall we say that because when we have a bad king like King Manasseh, that we're going to leave and join the Babylonians or the Assyrians? Or do we still stay, if we were Jews, let's say, in the days of King Manasseh? Are we going to stay with it and be faithful no matter what happens? That's what we have to do. Now, I think we have never looked at the story of the Bible in terms of this question of how God was governing his church. I think we just see it as men doing things. But you know, we have just the same problem in families today. There's some families whom God works with and some who he has a very hard time working with. The state of every family is probably indicative today of the state of the church through all the periods of time from the days of Moses till now. We have our highs and our lows. There was the time of Haggai and Zechariah when the people became zealous again. They drifted away. They came back in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. There, men exercised very strong authority, especially in the case of Nehemiah, who broke up intercultural and interracial matters and the preservation of the state, or there would not have been a Jewish identity today. But at other times, this hadn't occurred at all, because it was not critical. So sometimes someone who governs rigidly. Now, Moses was a meek man. In a sense, God ruled and was allowed to rule almost directly, but God doesn't always choose to do that. In the case of Ezra and Nehemiah, we have in the person of Nehemiah a man who ruled with a firmer hand than anyone I know of in the whole of the Old Testament, a far firmer hand than David ever did. I can't imagine Nehemiah letting the nation getting away with what David allowed his sons to do, one of whom he had never even corrected in his life, it said. Now, undoubtedly, you can be as strict as Nehemiah, and then there are carnal people who will want to make that some kind of rigid rule. And you can have people who might be as liberal as some of the kings were and allowed various things to go on. This is just their approach, and everybody wants it to be that way. The end result is that we all have to learn to submit our lives directly to Jesus Christ. Because every human being will be somewhere along this spectrum of rigidity or permissiveness in what we allow ourselves and our family, and in a sense, if we're ministers, what we allow the church to do and to be like. And we're all going to be judged for how we approach the problem in the situation in which we are. God chose to have a strong man in the days of Nehemiah. Without him, there would have been no Jewish community surviving to this day. On the other hand, there are people who were carnal-minded who would have taken the rigid rules that Nehemiah operated by. And, of course, many of them did. And so Judaism in the New Testament was a kind of religion that was a straight-laced yoke of bondage. The Jews couldn't even drink the Greek wine. The Greek feet may have stamped it out. They couldn't heal on the Sabbath. They had to wait till the sun went down. Because Nehemiah said, you can't do business on the Sabbath. And they stretched it to include all of these other things. There was a reaction, of course, to that we have in the days of Antiochus Epiphanes, and then a reaction to that, and they got back to much more of the rigidity that was in the days of Nehemiah. And we can see the same thing. Different congregations in the New Testament church behave differently. Certainly, the libertine way of life of the Corinthians is reflected in what they allowed among themselves that we don't find reflected, for instance, in the letter that Paul wrote to the Philippians. And we can look through the history of the church through all time and see the same thing, that the church will vary according to the environment in which it lives and will reflect to some extent the leadership of the church for a period of time. Now, what we have to do as individuals is recognize that as you go through, and I think we ought to read the Bible from a point of view of how God chose to govern, and the fact that he often lets the government reflect the state of mind of the individual or individuals through whom he directly or indirectly works. Every child, in the end, is subject to whatever government a parent exercises. Children have no choice in that, any more than as a group of people we have choice in how God should choose to govern this body whom he has called to do a work. We have to face that reality. Now, we are in a period, Mr. Wayne Cole has called it a time of discontinuity, which of course is a term that we find used in literature today, that certain things break and traditions that were typical, let's say, in the Eisenhower administration or the Kennedy administration or that go back to the days of Franklin Delano Roosevelt are no longer the same. The bomb has changed things. Television has changed things. The new morality, women's liberation. All these things are reflected in the lives of people whom God calls. They're reflected also in the lives of people whom God calls to the ministry. And the approach will be different. Shall we therefore assume that because it's different from one time to another, that Christ is not governing? Or shall we let Christ govern? And shall we let him also govern each of us as individuals? And what Christ may allow your neighbor, you might discover he doesn't ask you to allow yourself. Or what the ministry may not allow you, you discover Christ would have allowed. I will use an illustration, meat offered to an idol. When the question originally arose, the apostles decided in Acts 15, under the inspiration of the Spirit of God, that the people should not eat meat sacrificed to idols. What it says there, Acts 15. Yet later on, we find that Paul must have exercised the government in such a way that people were able to do that without severe discipline in the church. And that when they did, what Paul had to say is, remember the conscience of somebody else. If you're seen eating meat in the idol's temple, his conscience will embolden him to do the same thing, and since he thinks the idol is something, he would be back into idolatry again. Now, there are ministers in the church, undoubtedly, who would have said anybody who is found in the idol's temple is expelled. And there are others who would have said, well, anybody who is found in the idol's temple, let him enjoy the meal. And there are others who would have spoken like Paul did, be concerned for the conscience of another. And brethren, it would have been left to you to determine what God's mind is on the basis of what the Spirit of God had revealed. In my judgment, Paul would have been right when he said that if you are there and no one's conscience is defiled, there is no reason why you couldn't be there. But if somebody else's conscience is defiled and you are in a situation where you could even be seen that could affect somebody else, then don't do it. Now, I have a custom when I'm with my Muslim friends in the month of Ramadan, the fast month, I do not eat with them during the daylight. I eat with them at night like they do. When I'm with any Seventh-day Adventist friends, I do not drink wine or eat meat. I eat vegetables rather than vegetables. I don't go for the substitutes either. I try to eat what I think a person ought to eat when he's eating real vegetables and not vegetables made into meat that aren't really meat after all. We have to be concerned with the conscience of another. There are people who will leave the church
and have less and cause disruption. That's part of the problem in San Diego, where individuals have caused disruption because they said at one time the church regulated women's church plans. And therefore, people ought to wear the same thing now, and anybody who doesn't is not righteous. Now, the fact is that some women wear skirt lengths that clearly indicate they're not righteous. And some women who wear the right skirt length clearly indicate they're not righteous by causing division about it. You need to be concerned with what you do and how you affect the other person. There was a time where Mr. Armstrong said I had to be more careful because I allowed on the cover of the Plain Truth once a picture of girls in tennis shorts walking between the dormitory and the tennis court. And we had so many responses against it. And then there was a time where we had girls fully clothed in some kind of a winter suit, you know, a sweatsuit, from neck to feet. And there wasn't any skin showing. And I deliberately put that in because we had them with their legs in the air exercising, see? And some women said women shouldn't be dressed like that. I felt they needed a lesson at that point. But there are people who today would be quite different, who have had an article on the pygmies in 1955 instead of 75, would not have raised eyebrows, it would have shut eyes. Today, it raised only a few eyebrows. Like one woman said, "What will you now show, naked white people, the next thing?" But I didn't get more than one or two letters like that. We would have gotten hundreds of letters before. The morality has changed in the sense of what people see isn't the same thing. Now, undoubtedly, our great-grandparents dressed in such a way that it seemed respectable to them. When I look back at the dresses of the 1890s, I would say only a fool would wear something like that. But the people who were wearing it were not. But anybody today who would be. I think it is absolutely foolish what people sometimes have done. Cramping their feet, putting these, whatever it was, they put around to their waist. Yet that was the style in that day. People seem not to have thought anything of it. And to have dressed like we dress today would have been a scandal. So we have to realize that there are many things that can change, and there are other things that don't. We must discern the difference between those that are important, that are spiritual and unchangeable, and the things that are physical and changeable. I think we have to recognize that. There is a time when, long ago, we had the brethren drink the wine at the Passover all at once. And I continued that longer than Mr. Armstrong did, so he didn't even realize he had once done it, and thought I was getting into Catholicism. There was a time Mr. Armstrong ruled this church so strictly that probably a quarter of the people would leave today if he ever ruled it now as he did then. Same man, but he's not doing it the same way. But that doesn't mean now that every parent can be lax in responsibility. The fact is, Mr. Armstrong has other things to do besides merely tending the flock and being sure that nobody goes astray anywhere. And it's left to others. And they vary in their approach. And the larger the church becomes, the greater the variation. I think we have to face that reality. Business itself is part of the environment in which we live, both in the world and among ourselves. And business produces diversity. There is no way to have the kind of unity we had when everybody attended one Feast of Tabernacles and everybody heard the same set of sermons.
And anybody who didn't preach the same set in principle, that is, go along with the same approach, didn't speak again, or was spoken about in the next sermon. That's just a fact. I think we have to realize bigness takes its toll, but also bigness is a necessity if the job must be done. Therefore, the bigger we get, the greater the responsibility that rests on each individual's shoulders. The smaller the group, the greater the responsibility that can be resting on the government, I should say on the shoulders, of those who may be directly under Christ's governing. But the larger we become, the more difficult it is, because, you know, we can have a minister over 30 people. We can have a minister over 50, over 130, over 250. You know, over 330, and you discover that the minister's time doesn't expand. It stays the same. In fact, it usually contracts because he has more children now than before. And that takes time. And so we have a situation where more and more the government of God is exercised less and less by the very nature of bigness, not to mention the nature of our different approach in the 70s in the whole environment around us. So that the greater responsibility today rests on us individually than ever before. And the responsibility is to remember that one of the great cardinal sins is not just one of the Ten Commandments. If you look at some of the things that God hates most, one is to cause division among brethren. And it's a very great tragedy that some men who think they are maintaining the faith are themselves the cause of division. Some think they're maintaining it by introducing something new. Some think they're maintaining it by not being willing to correct themselves when the church must step forward as Christ leads. It is our duty as brethren to know where God works, and this is it, in terms of getting out His message, which is the fundamental function that God has asked the ministry to perform. Now, when God shows that He no longer is doing that, or when another message is being preached, which it is not, at the highest level, then we have a reason to reconsider where Christ is working. But all who have left have laid aside that kind of effort, and they are feeding on people on the periphery of the church who may try to get their hands on. Now, all of this is made very plain in a chapter that I do want you to take note of. And I will just refer you to it because we are at the close. Sometimes we have overlooked how many things in the Bible refer to us. Just look at chapter 34 of the book of Ezekiel. Now, God's seat may be national Israel. God's seat also may be the church. He speaks of His flock in verse 17. They're individuals who have trodden on the word of God, who have muddied the waters, so to speak, in verses 18 and 19. Individuals who have lorded it over others, fattened themselves, and spiritually left others lean. You can have all kinds of symbolism. People who want to have their own way and are not concerned with how it affects brethren. There are ministers who left, in fact, who literally fattened themselves financially and left some of the brethren lean. There is far more here than you realize. There are individuals who have failed to heal the sick, in verse 4, who have, in fact, caused others, some of the sheep, to be driven away and have not sought that which was lost. Some who have ruled with force and rigor. I'm reading the Jewish translation. All that's in verse 4 of chapter 34. And of course, there's going to be a far greater time of crisis ahead. There are many of these verses that do not just apply to national Israel. They apply to the state of the church more at one time than another. Because the church throughout history has had its ups and downs. And unfortunately, some of the men who have left today in this era of the church have failed to realize that they should hold to the head who is Jesus Christ. And they have sought to divide and to pull away individuals after them. And there's some who remain behind who haven't been doing their duty, where the flock is just sort of drifting away. Because people seem to be going out in some areas as many as are coming in. And that reflects something on the spiritual state. We have to ask whether indeed the ministry is, as it should be, feeding the flock. Now, I hope you realize, brethren, that we are in a time when there is a greater responsibility on our shoulders to recognize what few have ever done. And that is that Christ does not always govern the church as we think he would have. Nor does he always govern it the same, because he works through individuals, and those individuals will vary in their apprehension of that government. Just the same as in every family, Christ does not rule that whole family the same. Because we're all going to be judged. And some are going to be judged during a time, I should say, for a time when there was strict government. And they're going to be judged how well they handle the sickness. And some are going to be judged when there is much more permissiveness. And you're going to be judged how much you allowed yourself that you knew you shouldn't. Or whether you had good judgment enough to know what you could allow others when others perhaps were not allowing. We're all going to be judged by how well we comprehend and apply what is in this book we call the Bible.
Let's take our hymnal for the final song this afternoon, and please stand. Turn to page number 36, Come See the Works of God, after which Mr. Mike Giesel will close in prayer. Page number 36.
God in heaven, we come before your throne now at the close of this service. We thank you very much for the inspiration that you've given, for the message that we've heard, and I ask you now that you will help us to look to you and